Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
The Drive Nation podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
We're recording this podcast on the Monday morning after the first Grand Prix of the very much delayed 2020 Formula One season. We've been waiting 7 months for an F1 race. And I think the wait was worth it, wasn't it, Andrew? It was a real cracker to get the new season underway.
Yeah, first of all, hello, everybody. And secondly, yes, it was. I mean, I stayed awake through an entire Grand Prix. I don't tend to stay awake through much on a Sunday afternoon, but it was great. I mean, it started off, didn't it? There was some interesting stuff, obviously, with Lewis getting his grid penalty and, you know, not getting pole from the get-go. But it's still, you know, when those two Mercedes were just sort of like way ahead of everybody else, we could see the way it was all going.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, yeah, stuff started happening, didn't it? People started falling off, cars started breaking, and we ended up with, I think we ended up with some really interesting outcomes and some really encouraging performances. So, yeah, great race. Whether that actually means much for the season to come, I remain to be convinced about.
Yeah, so we're following last week's podcast with this one. Last week we previewed the start of the 2020 season, and I think we were slightly sceptical, weren't we, about what the first race of the 2020 season might deliver. I think we were expecting Lewis dominance and not a great deal by way of competition. Well, I mean, first of all, Valtteri Bottas looks incredibly racy.
But he does
at times, though, doesn't he?
He did last year, didn't he?
Exactly.
And we all went woo. And yeah, I mean, this is my concern for this season is that, you know, is that, I mean, Valtteri, yes, did look pretty good this time last year or at the start of last year's season, and then obviously Lewis ran away with it. And also, you know, we know that the Mercedes has never gone particularly well around that circuit, and we know that Mercedes develops their car through the year. They turn up with the best car, and then they make it even better at a rate that the others can't match through the rest of the year. I mean, Ferrari coming P2, I mean, they would have bought that all day long before the race. I mean, I think that, you know, I think Martin Brundle said that they're the fifth best team out there at the moment, and absolutely, I would agree with that. They seem to be behind the Racing Point, and they seem to be behind McLaren, let alone Red Bull and Mercedes. So, you know, it was a great race to watch, but, you know, I think our predictions were, of course, completely wrong for this particular race, but I think over the course of the season, sadly, I think we may be slightly closer to the truth.
Yeah, well, I think we stand by what we said, that it's another Mercedes year, isn't it? We'll have to review that a few months from now and see how right or how wrong we got it. But I think we still stand by that prediction for the time being, at least. Partly because the Red Bull ring hasn't necessarily favoured the Mercedes over the years. And yet they were half a second clear of Max in the Red Bull in qualifying. So that car's still a gun, isn't it, that Mercedes?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, you wait till you start to get it, start getting to the really fast circuits with the really long straights, and that engine's allowed to let go. I mean, the Red Bull did look mighty impressive in the corners, didn't it? I mean, for Alex Albon to be able to drive around the outside of Lewis in a corner, I mean, geez. If you just think about that, you know, this young guy who I don't think before he came into F1 anybody particularly rated. I mean, people were always talking about Lando and they're talking about George Russell. And, you know, Albon was kind of the sort of, oh, yeah, and there's him as well. And now look at him. I mean, he had a, you know, he had a great race, I think at Spa last year. And, you know, he got driver of the day yesterday on the Sky coverage. And, you know, and fair play, you know, driver of the day, despite what Lando did at the end of it. But as you say, yeah, I still think that Mercedes, once they get onto the circuits that suit them more, I think they're going to run and hide, I'm afraid.
So it was interesting from the start. We saw Valtteri kind of shoot off the line and build up a gap over Max quite quickly. And sadly, we didn't get to see what Max was able to do in that race because some sort of mechanical or electrical failure put him out on lap 11. What do you think that he had anything up his sleeve? Do you think maybe with a little bit of strategy and the safety cars, he could have been a more of a thorn in the side, couldn't he?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you take the view, and it's an entirely partial one, but certainly Christian Horner thought that Alex could have won the race. And Alex obviously thought Alex could have won the race and the rate that he was gaining at the end on his tyres. Now, I don't think that, you know, although I think we're all being surprised and impressed by Alex Albon, I don't think that there are many people who would yet put him in the same league as Max. So if, you know, Alex was in a position to win the race, then you'd think that Max, with a, you know, if his car hadn't let down, would be doubly so. I think it could have been really quite interesting up front. I think, you know, with both Mercedes out there, my money would still have been on Bottas to win it. But yeah, who knows? I mean, you know, the good news is we've got next weekend, so maybe we'll get to find out what those Red Bulls can do from the get go. But I mean, you know, another very interesting characteristic of that race was just the number of cars. It just broke down. Things fell off them. The cars coasted. I can all remember, you know, obviously Formula One in the 1980s when this kind of happened like all the time, and, you know, 8-9 cars retiring from a single race was, you know, not only you know, commonplace, it usually happened. It's interesting, isn't it? Because they said, oh yeah, it's first race of the season and that sort of thing, but it's, you know, there's always a first race to every season. And yeah, I just don't really understand why stuff was packing up at quite the rate that it did.
I think the curbs around Austria cause cars lots of trouble, don't they? If you ride them too hard.
Yeah, they did, but people know that, don't they? It's not like it's the first time they've raced at the A1 ring. You know, they will all have all the data from all the impacts on all the curbs right around that circuit. And, you know, maybe it was drivers who were rusty and their drivers were just using that inch or two more space than they would do normally and therefore getting up curves they wouldn't normally be hitting. I don't know. It's interesting.
I remember watching it and seeing all these cars drop out and all the safety cars. And I just thought, wow, you can tell it's been 7 months since anyone's tried to do this, can't you? let's talk a bit more about Alex Albon, because, well, he was one of the big talking points from the race. And you're quite right to say that he hasn't been rated up until now quite as highly as some of the other younger British guys. But, I mean, he really was on it yesterday. I think we have to acknowledge that he qualified half a second off Max. So there is a big gap there. And I think if he's going to establish himself as, you know, one of the top draw drivers in Formula One over the next few years, I think he is going to have to try and close that gap in qualifying, isn't he? You know, despite that, he still found himself in a position, perhaps with some safety car fortune, he did find himself in a position to potentially win the race. He was, with 11 laps to go, he was on the tail of the two Mercedes. He was sort of very briefly past one of them on new soft tyres, while the Mercs were both on old hard tyres. He really could have won that race. You really don't win races through blind luck alone. But of course, the big talking point, and something that we have to address now, particularly because you've been watching Formula One for a long time, Andrew, and you've done a lot of racing yourself as well. We have to talk about the Hamilton Albon incident. Where do you stand?
To me, there's only one way of looking at it. You know, it was a racing incident, but it was Lewis's fault. And actually, I'm going to come on to another point, which I think is quite is also interesting in a minute. I mean, okay, point one. I mean, how gutsy to drive, you know, for young Alex Albon to try and drive around the outside of Lewis Hamilton. I mean, that actually, more than anything else, is what really makes me optimistic about Alex Albon, because, you know, whatever else he is, he may not be quite as quick as Max, but goodness me, he's a racer, isn't he? You know, he's not one of these guys who's going to be, you know, let himself be, you know, intimidated by a 6-times world champion. He'll just think, not only will I, you know, overtake this bloke, I'm going to go around the outside of him. And, you know, you don't put moves on that, you know, very few people put moves like that on Lewis Hamilton. And, you know, very simply, at the time that the cars connected, you know, Alex was well ahead. I mean, you know, the fact it was Lewis's front tire against Alex's rear tire, tells you all you need to know. You know, Alex couldn't go anywhere else. But, you know, it was unfortunate. And absolutely, it was no, despite the fact that it happened in Brazil last year, and that is unfortunate, but that is a coincidence. There's no way Lewis intended that. It was just, you know, he was committed, he was on a trajectory, and it was just one of those things. But yeah, I mean, if you have to point the finger anywhere, then you point it at Lewis. But you also accept it was a racing accident. The only thing I think is a shame is, you know, and I don't suppose there's anything you can do about it, is, all right, you know, Lewis got a 5-second penalty, but he still very nearly got, I mean, if it hadn't been for Lando's insane last lap, Lewis would still have been on the podium. And Alex got nothing. Now, whether Alex's retirement was a result of the impact, who knows? But it seems a real shame to me that someone who tried that hard and made that kind of effort should be rewarded with, you know, without a single point. But, you know, I think potentially going forward, it's encouraging, because, you know, if he's going to have a go at guys like Lewis, then bring it on.
Yeah, I think I tend to side on the racing incident sort of conclusion. That's what I feel. I think Albon was incredibly brave to try around the outside of a corner that had a huge gravel trap right there. And that's, you know, that's what we want. We do want drivers to be brave, and we do want consequences. We don't want huge runoff areas. So that's all good stuff. However, I do wish that he'd just waited a little bit longer. I wish he'd been slightly more patient and found a safer way to get past Hamilton and then perhaps past Bottas as well.
Yeah, but you know, he had to make the most of those tyres, didn't he? Because if he'd waited another, you know, Lewis would have been wise to that and would have shut that door, you know, from there on in. And, you know, he had to make the most of those tyres while they were still, you know, it was going to get harder for him every lap from then on in, because, you know, his tyres were going to age. And, you know, I think he just saw his moment and he went for it. What I would like to know, and I don't know, because, you know, I've been in situations where, you know, someone's tried to come around the outside of me, and I've been in some old shed and it's been sort of sliding out. And certainly in a lot of the old stuff that I race, because it's incompetent and sometimes quite heavy cars, you can't just change your line. And you're committed, you know, the car's going to go where the car's going to go, and you can't change that. And if there's a car there, you're going to hit it. What I don't know is, with a modern Formula One car, whether if you just sort of turn it a bit more, or if you lift a bit, you can angle a car back into towards the corner, so that you can give a competitor a bit of racing room. I just don't know how throttle sensitive they are. I just don't know. I mean, I presume if it's Lewis and he's absolutely on it, there is no margin for error. But I would love to know. I would love to understand more what options, if any, Lewis had.
Yeah, he's on old hard tyres. I suspect he's giving it everything he can to try and close that door and not lose the position. I suspect that once he was committed to his line, there's nothing he could do. I don't think he could have trimmed his line to give Alex more space. This is why I think it's a racing incident, because what would Hamilton have had to have done to have avoided that incident? Well, he would have had to bailed out of his robust defence very, very early on, probably during turn into the corner. And that's certainly not what we want to see in Formula One. You know, we want robust defence and robust attacks that stay on the right side of clean. But, you know, the consequences were so great for Albon that, yeah, 5 seconds. You can't, I don't think you can argue too hard, really.
No, I mean, Alex was saying that, you know, in his mind, you know, the move was made. He was so far ahead. He said he was actually thinking about, right, I've got to go and get Valtteri now. And then there was, I don't know, it'll just be one of those things, but it was a shame. But even so, I think we have to sort of see the big picture. And I think the fact that there is, you know, one more young gun out there, doing his stuff, and challenging the establishment, has got to be good news.
It really has. One last thing to say on that. I heard, Nico Rosberg talking a few weeks ago about Hamilton, and he made a very, very good point. He said that in wheel-to-wheel battles, Hamilton's real skill is to drive in such a way that anything he does is always in the grey area. Okay, so like his defence here, it's in the grey area. It's debatable whether or not it's fair. Okay, and that's maybe his key skill in wheel-to-wheel battles. And Rosberg said that whenever he tried to pull something similar, he always stepped into the black zone where it's quite clearly his fault, and there was no debate around it. I just thought that was fascinating.
And I think grey areas with driving as well as with, you know, with race regulations, I mean, that's where you make the difference, isn't it? You know, grey areas are not against the rules, and if you can live in those grey areas, and I think Nico's absolutely right, then, you know, I don't think drivers should be criticised for that. You know, they have to make the most of whatever they can do within the framework that they have. And I think that he's absolutely right. I think Lewis is better at that than anybody else. But on the subject of Lewis, I think on the podcast last week, or I've certainly said it before, I have said that I've just thought that Lewis is in a complete league of his own at the moment, referring to his performance, particularly last season, where, you know, so far as I could see, he just didn't make a mistake all season. And yet, this weekend, he made a mistake in qualifying, which got him a grid drop, and he made a mistake in the race, which cost him a podium. What, if anything, are we to read into that?
He does every now and again have a slightly scruffy weekend. It's very unusual, but he did in Brazil, again with Albon last year. He did in Germany at Hockenheim. Do you remember what happened? He went off where a few drivers went off towards the end of the lap and nudged the wall, lost his front wing, you know, cut the pit lane entry. And his race kind of unraveled from there. And I think he scored 1 point in the end, didn't he? But it was a very, very bizarre off weekend for him. So it happens occasionally. I suspect what we'll see now is him come back and be faultless this weekend, and remind us why we all think he's in a league of one at the moment.
Yeah.
But we'll have to wait and see. I mean, remember as well that he hasn't tended to love Austria, but next we have Hungary, which he's won, I think, more than any other driver. And then two races at Silverstone. So, you know, even if he has a slow start to the season, I suspect he'll do some catching up fairly rapidly. Well, let's have a little think about Ferrari, because as we know, Andrew, I think when you were on Chris Harris's Collecting Cars podcast, he made the point that if we cut you, you bleed Maranello.
Yeah, well, particularly as far as Formula One is concerned. Is it fragile? I kind of regard the race team and the road cars as two entirely separate entities. But yeah, certainly so far as Formula One is concerned, I am an unashamed Ferrari supporter.
So pretty galling then to hear them say before the start of the weekend that they've got this wrong and we're not going to be competitive.
Yeah, absolutely. But also, you know, it's if you are somebody who, however much you might admire Mercedes, just loves the idea of great close competitive racing at the top level in Formula One, you know, Ferrari not being able to do that is just one less reason to be interested in the sport. And it was galling, and, you know, let's hope that their big aerodynamic update for Hungary is going to fix the problem. But, you know, I personally, and I don't know what your views are on this, you know, I do not think it is a coincidence that their form last year fell off a cliff when people started investigating their engine. And of course, you know, the results of the FIA inquiry have been kept secret, and it's absolutely right to ask why that might be. But what we do know is that, you know, right up until that moment, Ferrari appeared to have, if not the best, then certainly one of the best two cars on the grid. And since then, they really, really struggled, and they're still struggling. And, you know, hopefully a big aerodynamic update will get them closer to the front. But I think, frankly, their problems go rather deeper than that. I just don't think they've got the power anymore.
It's you're right, it's much more than a coincidence. It's also quite shady, isn't it, the way it's been handled by Ferrari and the FIA. So in Austria, they were the fastest Ferrari. Charles Leclerc was a second off in qualifying. Seb didn't even make the top 10 shootout, Q3. And then, well, let's talk about Leclerc first, because he still finished second. There is some fortune in that, because a couple of cars dropped out, and the safety car periods just shook up the whole thing. But nonetheless, he put what seems to be a bit of a pig of a car in second, and that is a sign of a very, very capable driver.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, if you think that on pure speed alone, if you take Martin Brundle's view, which I do, that, you know, the Ferrari right now are behind the Mercedes, the Red Bulls, the Racing Points and McLaren. You know, if everybody has like a normal race, he's coming eighth. No, he's not. He's coming ninth, isn't he? I think he just didn't make a mistake, did he? He made the absolute most of the limited resources that were available to him. And like all great racing drivers do, you know, when the luck came, he was there to make the most of it. And good on him. But, you know, don't go, you know, ripping up all expectations now and thinking that Ferrari is going to be, you know, back up the front next weekend. Can't see it. Really can't see it. I think they got lucky.
Yeah, flattered, aren't they?
I think Charles made the most of that luck, but I don't think any more than that.
What about the other car?
I mean, dear. I mean, it was another, enforced error, wasn't it? It was, you know, we've just seen it so many times before. I mean, he was off the pace in quali. He didn't shine particularly. There was a time in the race, actually, when he seemed to be doing quite well. And then, you know, it was a wildly overambitious move. I couldn't see that ever having a happy outcome, unless he was expecting the other driver to just go, all right, well, I'll just kind of, you know, drive around the outside of the track. Well, that's not what you do. It's not a good start, is it?
No, this is Vettel. So, of course, it's a strange season for him because we know he's on his way out of the Scuderia at the end of this season. And so we all wondered, well, what's that going to mean for him? Is it going to be a rocket up his backside and we're going to see him driving out of his skin just to try and prove that he has still got it, he hasn't lost anything? Or is he going to carry on in the same sort of form? And it seems to be the latter, doesn't it? It was a clumsy mistake, the type that we've seen time and time again over the past couple of years. It was bizarre to watch. Even he tried to bail out of that move at the last minute, knowing that he'd got it wrong. And it seems strange whenever he comes together with another car, he rotates.
Yeah, I mean, it really saddens me, actually, because, you know, I'm not, you know, I know how easy it is for British media, because they did it to Schumacher as well, to take drivers like him and Vettel and turn them into sort of, you know, pantomime villains. I was never like that with Michael. I've never been like that with Sebastian. And it kind of reminds me of a sort of, you know, a boxer who's just sort of had one fight too many, and is trying to recapture his former glories and is trying too hard and making mistakes. And I just don't like seeing, you know, and the strange thing is, you know, if he was 40, I'd be going, well, he's 40. What do you expect? But he's not. I can't remember what he is, but he's like 31, 32. He's still he's younger than Lewis, a lot younger than Lewis. And it pains me to see, you know, a once great career going in the direction that it's going in currently. Now, of course, you know, you can't tell anything from a single weekend, and maybe next weekend he'll be, you know, out ahead of his teammate and, you know, making the most of what he's got. But, you know, so far it's not encouraging.
No, there is some onboard footage doing the rounds on social media of Seb's car. And I don't know which stage of the race it was, but it just looks a pig to drive.
Yeah.
It's snapping on him on every turn in. And I think in his post-race interview, he said, didn't he, that he was surprised he only spun once. And he was clearly struggling enormously with that car. Is that mitigating? I don't know. I suspect not really.
Do you think that's because they've had such a drop in engine power? Because it's slower than it was last season, I think, isn't it?
Charles's qualifying lap was a second slower than his pole time last year.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? So, and maybe Vettel's answer to that, or way to try to mitigate that, is to trim the car out as much as possible. So you've at least got some straight line speed. But then, you know, there's inevitable price in downforce paid for that. And maybe that's why the car was so difficult. I don't know. Can we talk about Lando?
Well, okay, we will do. Racing Point very quickly in the 2019 spec Mercedes. Looking very quick at points, really dicing with the quick guys up there, which is good to see. Hopefully they'll be a bit more of a factor throughout this 2020 season. But yes, McLaren.
McLaren. Okay, can I ask you a question? I'll be honest with you. Somebody came up with this fact on Twitter in a response to something I'd written, so I'd not even thought about it. When was the last British driver, when did a new British driver last score his first podium position in Formula One?
Was it start of the 2007 season?
It was Lewis.
Was it Lewis?
In Australia in 2007. It's been 13 seasons since a British driver last scored a maiden podium.
Wow. Okay, so yesterday was a big, big day.
Yeah, big day. Big day. Did you see his last lap?
Yeah.
It was, if anybody's listening to it and you haven't seen it, there is a... you can see it on the official F1 channel, but there's also there's somebody who posted it without all the bleeps, and so you can hear the language, and it's the amazing thing about that last lap, despite the fact that he was knackered, his tyres were knackered, and everything else, it's just flawless. He's not sort of flinging it all over the place, but he is so on it. I'm myself sure that he caught Mercedes napping, because I'm sure that the Mercedes guys thought the gap, he's never going to close that gap. So don't worry about it, guys. Look after your gearboxes, because as we know, the Mercedes were in some trouble anyway. And then Lando goes and does that. And I couldn't be happier for him. I couldn't be happier for McLaren. I couldn't be happier for the fact that, a team other than a Mercedes, a Red Bull or a Ferrari is back on the podium.
Yeah, it's fantastic, isn't it? McLaren back up there. Hopefully, okay, so a couple of cars dropped down the order a bit, but hopefully we'll see more of that throughout the year. And fantastic that it's young Norris. That you're quite right, that last lap was a killer. And it was fascinating to hear his engineer almost coaching him through with the boost, toys that they've got.
Overtake for 5 seconds now. Do you know, because I don't, there was, some regulation not that long ago saying that you can't...
Yes. Yeah, I was going to bring this up. You're absolutely right to mention it.
So in what way is that not helping your driver?
I don't know. I don't know if it's been quietly relaxed, that rule, or if, that somehow that doesn't quite fall under it. But I thought we'd heard the end of engineers coaching drivers through a lap like that.
They're allowed to sort of say, well, you need to come in and change your tires now, but as far as offering advice on how to make your car, particularly on how to make your car go faster, I think they can still do it if it's a reliability thing. You need to limit your revs or cool your brakes. I think they can perhaps do that. But in terms of just giving pure advice on how to drive your car quicker, I didn't think you can do that. But clearly you can, because I'm sure somebody far more intelligent than me would have flagged it up by now.
Well, yes. I mean, you can bet that Mercedes or somebody would have raised a challenge there. There must be a reason why they haven't. So 7 days after the Austrian Grand Prix, we've got the Styrian Grand Prix, also at the Red Bull Ring. So I reckon we should both make predictions now for what we're going to see on Sunday. You go ahead then, Andrew.
Lewis wins it, Valtteri second, Max. Yeah, I think it's going to be the kind of the calm after the storm, I'm afraid. I think that, they'll have so much data. Everybody will know so much more than they did before Sunday afternoon, and Mercedes made mistakes, which you don't usually see. I don't expect that to happen again. The thing you have to remember is, as we saw in quali, that car is just faster than anything else out there, which means that unless the unexpected happens, they're just going to romp away, and I fear that they will. For me, I just, it's the two. Well, I know that Alex is he's British born, he's a Thai who's British born, but I just hope that the two, that Lando and Alex continue their form. It was very interesting to me that Lando, got past Sainz and really, did a bit of a number on him, which I think bodes hugely well for the future. Because I think everybody understands that Carlos Sainz is a terrific driver. But I think going forward for the rest of the season, I'm afraid, see anything, which is going to make me alter my prediction that it will ultimately be a Mercedes steamroller. We have to remember that they don't usually go well in Austria. They've got the best car. I mean, they don't even have Ferraris to worry about anymore, so it would seem. And yeah, when you get onto those Mercedes friendly circuits, I'm afraid I think they're going to be gone.
Yeah, I wouldn't object to any of that. I think you're absolutely right. Well, there we go. We'll maybe have another chat about Formula One after the Austrian Grand Prix when, I don't know, Carlos Sainz has won and Lewis has stuffed it into a title. I don't know. It was unpredictable, wasn't it? And I just hope we see more unpredictability throughout the rest of the season. Okay, well, let's leave F1 there. And we're going to dig out a few of the most recent Drive Nation posts at Drive Nation _ on Instagram. Go and check it out if you're not already familiar with it. Now, the most interesting post and the most discussed post of the week, Andrew, was the Ineos Grenadier, which is okay to me. It looks like a reimagining of the old Defender, but they're quite determined that it's sort of the design has ended up that way almost because of the design brief rather than any specific intention to mimic any earlier models. Is that fair?
I mean, I think if you are them, you will want to sail as close to that wind as you possibly can. You are going to want to bathe in as much as that reflected glory. You're going to want to make the association, aren't you? I mean, clearly you're not going to want JLR lawyers bashing down your door. But, you know, the clear positioning of that car is to go into the space that the Defender vacated. And, you know, and obviously with the ladder chassis and with the live axles and, you know, all the hoo-ha about the fact that you can hose out its interior as well as its exterior, you know, that's the way they want that car to be perceived. So, you know, for me, it's like all these things. I mean, I attended a big sort of online presentation of the car and I was taught around it and everything else. And, you know, I think I know what it looks like, but you can never be sure until you see these things in the flesh, and particularly on the move, because it's always different. So I'm not going to rush to judgment right now. For myself, I do wish it looked a bit different. It had some identity of its own. I don't think it's as good looking as a Defender. I think that's a problem for me. I think underneath it, I think it's interesting. And, you know, don't underestimate Jim Ratcliffe and his determination to do what he feels he needs to do. You know, don't forget that the volume aspirations, which is only about 25,000 cars a year, are very low indeed. So it's not like they need to come in and, you know, give, you know, the Toyota Land Cruiser the fright of its life. They can all operate in the same space. And obviously, you know, I'm, you know, someone who, you know, has owned a series Land Rover for goodness knows how long. I just love the idea of people still being able to buy cars like that. Will it succeed? I hope so. I hope so. There is a gap in the market, but, you know, there are lots of people who've come on, haven't they, saying, well, yeah, but, you know, what's it doing that, you know, you can't go and buy a one-ton pickup and do for a lot less money?
It's caused such sort of debate on DN and everywhere else as well. I think one of the real hanging sticking points for a lot of people is that it just looks like a Defender clone visually, albeit with some sort of slightly more modern accoutrements. I'll wait until I've seen a finished car in the flesh, but I wasn't entirely persuaded by those digital renderings that we saw. So what do you think about... Okay, we know that whenever anyone comes into the car sector, it's one thing engineering and designing and manufacturing a good car, but then there's so much more to it after that. There's after sales, you need dealerships, you need service centres, the whole lot. Have they given any insight into how any of that stuff will function?
They have, but you know, they would say that the there is obviously going to be a network, and you know, Ineos does have the resources to set this up, and you know, and it's not like they're trying to sell millions of cars. To me, actually, the real challenge they've got and what really interests me is, you know, this car will not succeed if it only sells to farmers and, you know, NGOs and that sort of thing. It has to become fashionable. You know, it has, because more than anything else, you know, they're not going to make money if everybody just buys the cheapest version. It has to be, you know, and that's what kept the Defender alive for as long as it did. It wasn't, you know, outback doctors in Australia. It was fashionistas in Knightsbridge just love the idea of rumbling around the place in a Defender. Now, how you convince that lot with a car called an Ineos Grenadier that it is entitled to that cachet, the same cachet that, you know, the Land Rover Defender had, which the Defender had because, you know, it had been around for 70 years, and because it was a Land Rover, which in itself is a highly desirable brand. You know, they know they've got a job to do there. And it's how they do that, which is really, really going to interest me. You know, they've got some really clever guys working on that side of things, and, you know, things like the ad campaigns, the marketing. I'll just be really interested to see how they do it, because I think probably of all the challenges they've got, I mean, I don't doubt the car will be well engineered, because it's being engineered by Magna Steyr in Graz. These are the same people who build the G-Wagon for Mercedes-Benz. So these guys know what they're doing, particularly when it comes to live axles and ladder chassis. So I think the car itself, I'd be amazed if it wasn't sound. It's got BMW powertrains. It should be absolutely fine from all those regards. But as you say, making a car is one thing, selling it quite another.
You can't fault their ambition. I'd love to see a short wheelbase version. They haven't confirmed either way. They certainly haven't released any images of one. The sense I get is that for the London fashion crowd, the short wheelbase one will be the one that they're waiting for.
It always was, wasn't it? I mean, that was certainly the case with the Defender. And where they certainly have something over the current Defender is that, you know, that ladder chassis, okay, it may not be structurally rigid as a monocoque, but you can, it does mean that you can chop it into different lengths, so you can do a short wheelbase one quite easily. It also means you can bolt anything you like on top of it, which is, you know, which is one reason there's a pickup version of the Grenadier and there won't be a quick pickup version of the new Defender. So from that point of view, in terms of the sort of the platform versatility, you know, it already has one over the new Defender.
Do you think it's realistic that a single Grenadier will leave a showroom, if there's such a thing, costing £35,000?
A few. I think there will be a few you know, iconoclastic farmers who, you know, who just want to use one as a working tool in the fields, you know, that sort of thing. So yes, I think there will be a few. I mean, I think that there will be more base spec Grenadiers sold than there will be hard top Land Rover Defenders sold, but we'll see.
Interesting one. It's very yeah. We're going to enjoy seeing how that one unfolds. Talking of unfolding,
oh God, what have I done?
No, Ferrari F8 Spider's got a folding roof. You see,
very good, very good, very good. Yes. Would you say you've been enjoying yourself in that?
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah, it's an interesting one. Do you know what? 10 years ago, when I was in my early 20s, I would have loved rumbling around town in a yellow drop-top Ferrari. But I just feel a bit self-conscious now. Maybe it's because we're actually still in the midst of this whole pandemic, and driving around in a bright yellow convertible Ferrari just doesn't feel particularly sensitive. I don't know, but there was something about how visible that car is that made me feel a little bit uneasy, yeah. Which is a sort of a minor issue compared to some of the other problems that I have with that car. Last year, at the end of summer, I went to Maranello to drive the F8 Tributo, which is the fixed roof model. And I just thought it was kind of everything that a Berlinetta Ferrari mid-engine car could be and needed to be in 2019. I really got the sense that Ferrari had been evolving that platform over the years, as they have been since 2009, and they just got to a point where they're on top of it. And I thought it was really, really bloody good to drive. I really enjoyed it. And so I approached the Spider, optimistic, hopeful. But of course, I've driven Spider versions of earlier models, the 488 Spider in particular. And the issue that I have with that car is that it's just the chassis torsional rigidity just isn't there. When you peel away that roof, because it's a conventional aluminium monocoque, it's not a carbon tub like you get in a McLaren, you do lose a good amount of torsional rigidity. Now, I'm kind of in two minds about this, because it is annoying to feel the car creaking and shuddering around you. And as I've written, you don't just feel it. You actually hear it and you see it. You really do see that rearview mirror rattling away. It's a constant blur, particularly on a sort of rougher road. And that just tells you how much the head rail is moving, how much the whole body is flexing. And what's perhaps more annoying than that is that Therefore, bits of interior trim creak against each other. And you're always reminded that you're driving a compromised version of this amazing car. And that's a frustration for me. Having said that, you know, it still handles beautifully. It's still got that supple suspension, particularly in bumpy road mode, that deals with the worst of our roads sort of uncannily well. It does steer better than previous versions of this car, in a more calm, more sort of fluid, less flighty way. That engine, it's so strong, it's so responsive. I mean, it just makes a McLaren 720S engine look like it's got 1970s turbo lag. It's astonishing. It's a shame that it just doesn't sound better. It's got a gasoline particulate filter now, and of course it's twin turbocharged, and that means that old howling, wailing Ferrari flat plane crank V8 sound is long, long gone. And it's not such a big deal in the coupe, but with the roof off, you just can't ignore how kind of tuneless and flat the soundtrack is. And so although the F8 Spider is still a hugely capable and desirable machine, take away its roof and you've got a thing that rattles and wobbles around, and you're much, much more aware of the slightly disappointing soundtrack. And those two things make it a far less satisfying and exciting car than the coupe.
Whereas, you know, if we'd been having this conversation about any McLaren you like, which is available in open and closed form, then, you know, I don't know about you, but when I drive a McLaren Spider of any type, I basically can't tell the difference in terms of structural stiffness compared to the coupe version. And I mean, I think on the one hand, you can say, I suspect that you and I would be much more sensitive to that sort of thing than your average F8 Spider owner might be. But on the other, you know, it is a reason to not buy the car, isn't it? Or to be put off buying the car, if it is going to behave like that. It's very interesting. Well, I'm in it next weekend, so I shall see for myself.
It'll be interesting to see if you agree. So we're talking about F8 Spider. That really is actually an old Ferrari. Okay, it's the new Spider model, but it's based on the 488, based on the 458. So really, that platform has been with us for a long, long time. But you are soon going to drive an actual new Ferrari.
Yeah, I am. I am this week on Thursday, and this is something. I think this is our third attempt, to get out to Italy and drive this car. I am going to drive the SF90 on Thursday, which I am, as you can imagine, really, really excited about. I mean, I think it does sit on a massively developed version of the same of the same platform, and I actually asked the engineers why, with a car like this, so the SF90 has 1,000 horsepower. And, you know, I did ask why this was not the time to go to a carbon tub. And Ferrari still maintains absolutely that if you're not doing limited volume cars, like the LaFerrari and so on, that an aluminium tub, and this one does, the SF90 does have a bit, you know, quite, you know, some carbon fibre in it now. There's the rear bulkhead, for instance, is carbon fibre, but they're still adamant that aluminium is the way to go. But anyway, but this car is the SF9. I mean, it's so interesting. It's the, you know, it's the new flagship Ferrari, but it's only got 8 cylinders. Well, that's the first time that's happened. It's, you know, a four-wheel drive Ferrari, but it's mid-engined, and that's the first time that that's happened. It's Ferrari's first plug-in hybrid. There are so many firsts in it. And usually, if you get into an F8 Spider or whatever, then, you know, you've driven a Tributa, you've kind of got an idea what it's like. If you've driven a 488 and you're about to get into an F8 Tributa, you kind of got an idea what it's going to be like because you know where it's come from. SF90, I mean, I just don't know. I mean, on the one hand, it concerns me a bit because, you know, I don't know what you thought, but, you know, when I drive, you know, modern mid-engine Ferraris, I'm rarely sitting there thinking what I really, really could do with now is another 300 horsepower. But, you know, obviously, you know, it's got that power, but also it's got a load more weight that's come with it. You know, Ferrari, like McLaren, and this really annoys me, they always quote not only dry weights, which are usually about 100 kilos less than a curb weight, which everybody else quotes, but they always quote dry weights with all the lightest options fitted, which, you know, in the Ferrari's case is the list of light things that you can stick on it. You know, it just goes on forever. But I think, you know, the curb weight of a standard car is going to be well into the 1,700 plus kilos. And, you know, on the one hand, I think to myself, well, there's a load of power and I wonder if you need it, which comes with a load of weight, which I'm pretty sure you're not going to want. But on the other hand, I know these guys. I know how well they engineer stuff. And if anybody can square that circle, it's Ferrari. I mean, you know, there have been lots of times when I've gone out to drive a Ferrari and I thought, well, you know, this is where they've gone past optimum, or this car's going to have real problems, and they found a way around it. And it is so clever, certainly on paper, in terms of the technology, the torque vectoring, the way it deploys its electrically driven front axle. And I've also spoken to Raffaele Di Simone, their test driver, who's just a really, really good bloke. And I said, you know, what's it like compared to a Pista? And he says it's not the same as a Pista because it is heavier and it is more powerful. But, you know, he said it's different, but better, because it's quicker, because there's more stuff that you've got more options because of the way that you can play with the electronics and the four-wheel drive. And it's certainly, in terms of Fiorano lap times, it's certainly the quickest road car that Ferrari has ever made. And, you know, and what we're looking at is a standard production car. They are not limiting the production of this car, a standard production car with 1,000 horsepower.
Mm. Yeah, welcome to the new world of the hypercar. Is it a hypercar? Yeah, we're calling it a supercar.
I mean, just, I don't know. I mean, hypercars to me, it always sort of says limited. I mean, I think hypercars, and I think LaFerraris, and I think 918 Spiders, and I think McLaren P1s, and they're all limited cars. But, you know, it's got, you know, it's quicker than a LaFerrari. But, you know, in base form, it costs whatever it is, 300 and something thousand pounds, not £1 million. So, I mean, it's going to be fascinating. It's going to be, and there's no embargo on the story, so, you know, I'll be writing about it on DN this week. So it'll be, it'll be really, really interesting to see. I mean, it's always wonderful to go to Maranello and to drive any Ferrari, obviously, but I'm going to be particularly interested in what this one is like to drive. Not particularly knocked out by the idea of having to get on an aeroplane to go and drive it, but, you know, needs must, I guess.
Well, that's true. So you'll be travelling for the first time in a while. Are there any sort of precautions in place for that? If I were you, Andrew, I'd wear a racing helmet and not take it off until you got to your hotel room.
I mean, Ferrari have been amazingly good about the whole thing. I mean, they've talked us through the whole procedure. I mean, obviously, you have to wear masks and all that sort of thing when you're in public spaces like airports on an aircraft. You know, the SF90 that has been allocated to me, I'm the only person who will drive that car. It will have been fully sterilised before I get in it, and it will be fully sterilised before anybody else gets in it again after that. So how we do the in-car driving shot, I'm not quite sure, but we'll find a way. You know, my photographer will travel in a separate vehicle, which I think is going to be a sort of like a minibus, so he can be three rows behind the driver. I mean, they really have been, you know, pretty assiduous, and they clearly take it very seriously. I'm not quite sure whether that's because, you know, they're worried about them infecting us or us infecting them, but it doesn't matter, does it? It's, you know, it is reassuring to know that they have, you know, taken these things, as I say, very seriously.
Well, I was just going to say, there's very clearly a hierarchy here at Drive Nation, because while you are flying off to Maranello to drive the new SF90 Stradale, I'm going to be going to Millbrook to drive something less exotic. Although I have to say, I'm still quite looking forward to driving the Polestar 2.
Yes, well, I mean, again, another really, really interesting car. You know, Polestar, I mean, the Polestar 1, it wasn't a car which, you know, I for the money, I found it quite a flawed product, but it was interesting, wasn't it? And I think the Polestar 2, which is Volvo's, there's a Freudian slip. You can't say Volvo, can you? It's not a Volvo. It's got nothing to do with Volvo other than being owned by the same company. But it is their new all electric. It's a sort of Tesla Model 3 rival, isn't it?
Exactly right. Yeah, and it is the first Polestar, really, isn't it? Because the Polestar 1 was very limited edition, and it was a hybrid, which Polestars are not going to be.
And they're not limiting its top speed, are they?
Oh, that's right. Yeah, so I can do more than 112 if I'm running a bit late. Let's hope I'm not. There we go. I think there's also no embargo on that. So this week we'll have drives on both the SF90 Stradale and the Polestar 2. We're nothing if not a broad church.
No, and we've already done the drives of the Morgan Plus 4 and Plus 6. So that's three really interesting new cars this week.
Wow, so we've got Formula 1 back in another race this weekend, and three really intriguing cars to write about. We're back to it, aren't we? It really feels like we're getting back to it.
I think normal service is being resumed, and thank goodness for that.
What a relief. Okay, well, let's wrap that one up. Thank you, everybody, for listening. And I have to rattle through all this stuff because it is important. Please remember to rate the podcast, leave a little review wherever you get your podcasts, and do subscribe as well. That means you won't miss one, and it really does us a favour as well. Remember to check out Drive Nation on Instagram at DriveNation_. And we'll talk to you again next week when hopefully we've got another great race to get excited about.
Yeah, well, here's hoping. And obviously, also, if you fancied donating a little bit of money to help us continue to do this sort of stuff on Patreon, then you could do that, and we would be incredibly grateful. You can find us on patreon.com/DriveNation. Until this time next week, when we will have driven a load more stuff and had another Grand Prix, we bid you farewell.
Farewell, everyone. Goodbye.
The Drive Nation podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.